A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been watching the news about the U.S. slapping sanctions on Russian and Chinese firms that sold satellite imagery to Iran, imagery Iran then used to target American assets. His question is pretty practical. When the government wants to go after a specific company like that, how do they actually isolate just that one firm? And what does enforcement look like on the ground? Not the theory, but the mechanics. And honestly, there's a lot here most people never think about.
Before we dive in, fun fact, DeepSeek Vi4 Pro is writing our script today, which feels appropriate for a conversation about how governments track and isolate specific entities.
I'll take your word for it.
The satellite imagery sanctions Daniel's referring to, this actually happened. The Treasury Department designated several firms under an executive order targeting proliferation of conventional arms. The specific mechanism they used is something called the SDN list, specially designated nationals and blocked persons. And when a company lands on that list, it's not just a strongly worded letter, it's what OFAC calls a full blocking sanction.
OFAC being the Office of Foreign Assets Control, which sits inside Treasury.
And here's the thing most people get wrong. They think sanctions are just the U.S. government saying, don't do business with this company. But the SDN list triggers something far more concrete. Any property or assets that company has within U.S. jurisdiction, bank accounts, securities, real estate, anything, gets frozen immediately. Not seized, but frozen. The company can't access it, can't move it, can't transact with it. And here's the kicker. That applies not just to the company itself, but to any entity where that company owns 50% or more.
Wait, so if a sanctioned Russian satellite firm owns a majority stake in, say, a completely unrelated logistics company in Kazakhstan, that logistics company is also effectively sanctioned?
OFAC's 50% rule means you have to aggregate all ownership by blocked persons. If two different SDN-listed entities each own 30% of a company, that company is blocked. You don't need a separate designation. And this catches people constantly. Companies think they've done their due diligence, but they haven't traced the ownership chain deep enough.
That's part of the answer to Daniel's question about isolation. The sanction hits the specific company, but the 50% rule means it also radiates outward to anything that company meaningfully controls. But you said within U.S. jurisdiction. What about assets held entirely outside the United States?
That's where secondary sanctions come in, and this is where the enforcement gets teeth. Primary sanctions apply to U.S. persons, American citizens, U.S. companies, anyone physically in the United States, and any transaction that touches the U.S. financial system. But secondary sanctions say, even if you're a French bank with no U.S. presence, if you do business with this SDN-listed entity, the U.S. can cut you off from the American financial system entirely.
Since the dollar clearing system runs through New York,
almost every international transaction denominated in dollars passes through a correspondent bank in the United States at some point. If you're that French bank and you get hit with secondary sanctions, suddenly you can't clear dollars anymore. For most international banks, that's a death sentence for their cross-border business. So the enforcement mechanism isn't the U.S. sending agents to arrest people in Moscow or Beijing. It's making the global financial system enforce the sanctions for them.
Which is a remarkably elegant form of leverage when you think about it. You don't need to police the world. You just need to make it so expensive for anyone else to do business with your target that they isolate themselves.
The Treasury Department has gotten extremely sophisticated about how they structure these designations. Let me walk through what actually happens when they want to target a specific company. First, OFAC's Office of Global Targeting does an intelligence build. They pull from CIA, DIA, NSA, open source intelligence, financial records, shipping manifests, corporate registries. They're building an evidentiary package that shows exactly what this company did and why it meets the criteria for designation.
Before the public even hears about a sanction, there's probably months of investigative work.
and the package has to be legally defensible. Companies can challenge their designation in federal court, and they do. There's a whole body of case law around this. OFAC has to show that the evidence meets the standards set by whatever executive order or statute they're designating under. For the satellite imagery case, it was likely Executive Order 1338-2, which targets proliferators of weapons of mass destruction and their supporters, but it could also fall under the counterterrorism authorities depending on how Iran's IRGC was using the imagery.
Let's say they've got their package. They designate the company. It hits the SDN list. What happens in the first 24 hours?
The designation gets published on OFAC's website, and simultaneously, Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN, pushes out an alert to financial institutions. Every bank in the United States, and most major banks globally, runs automated screening against the SDN list. The moment that company's name appears, their algorithms flag any accounts, any pending transactions, any letters of credit. Those accounts are frozen within hours, sometimes minutes. The company shows up to work the next morning and their dollar accounts are inaccessible.
What about the actual satellite imagery firms in this case? I'm assuming Russian and Chinese companies don't keep most of their assets in US banks.
Probably not. But here's what they do have. They have contracts with other companies, many of which do have US exposure. They have insurance policies, they have reinsurance, they have technology licenses, they have cloud service providers. All of those counterparties now have to decide whether continuing the relationship is worth the risk of secondary sanctions. Most of them will walk away within days.
There's a term I've heard, de-risking. Banks and companies preemptively cutting off clients not because they're sanctioned, but because they might be adjacent to something sanctionable.
It's a real problem, but from the US government's perspective, it's also a feature. The ambiguity of secondary sanctions creates a chilling effect that's far broader than the actual legal requirements. If you're a European satellite ground station provider and you're not sure whether servicing a particular Russian firm's data puts you at risk, you're probably going to decline the business. The sanctions regime works partly through legal precision and partly through deliberate uncertainty.
Which raises a question Daniel might be getting at. How do they avoid collateral damage? If the chilling effect is so broad, how do you make sure you're only hitting the one company that actually provided imagery to Iran's IRGC?
There are a few mechanisms. One is the licensing system. OFAC can issue specific licenses that authorize otherwise prohibited transactions. So if there's a legitimate humanitarian reason to interact with a sanctioned entity, say providing medical supplies, you can apply for a license. But more relevant to Daniel's question, OFAC often issues general licenses alongside a designation that carve out specific activities.
Give me an example of how that works in practice.
Say the Russian satellite firm also provides imagery for agricultural monitoring that's used by UN food programs. OFAC might issue a general license saying transactions related to the provision of satellite imagery for humanitarian purposes are authorized. That way, the company is still blocked from everything else, but the specific activity that might cause collateral harm is carved out. These licenses are public. They're published on OFAC's website, and any bank or company can rely on them.
The precision comes from the combination of a very specific designation. This company, these named individuals, plus licenses that carve out the things you don't want to break.
There's another layer, the sanctions evasion guidance. OFAC published an advisory in 2024 specifically about the commercial satellite imagery industry, warning companies to be alert for customers who might be fronting for Iranian entities. So before the designations even happened, the industry had been put on notice about what to watch for. That's part of the isolation strategy. You signal to the ecosystem that a particular sector is under scrutiny, and the legitimate actors self-police.
I want to dig into something you mentioned earlier, the 50% rule. How do you even figure out who owns what when you're dealing with Russian or Chinese corporate structures? Those aren't exactly transparent jurisdictions.
This is genuinely hard, and it's one of the places where enforcement gets complicated. OFAC relies on a combination of sources. Corporate registries in various jurisdictions, some of which are public, some of which require legal process to access. Financial intelligence shared through the EGMONT Group, which is the international network of financial intelligence units. Treasury's own intelligence analysts. And increasingly, commercial data providers who scrape and aggregate corporate records globally.
Shell companies exist for exactly this purpose, to obscure ownership.
And OFAC has gotten more aggressive about piercing those. In 2024, they updated their guidance to say that they'll look through nominal ownership structures to identify who actually controls an entity. So even if a sanctioned Russian oligarch technically only owns 49% of a company on paper, if OFAC determines they exercise actual control, they make the decisions, they appoint the board, they control the bank accounts, they'll treat that entity as blocked.
That seems like it would create a lot of legal gray area. How do banks know whether OFAC considers a particular entity to be controlled by a blocked person?
They don't always, and that's part of the de-risking problem we mentioned. But OFAC does publish guidance, and there's a whole compliance industry that's grown up around interpreting it. Major banks have entire sanctions, compliance departments, hundreds of people whose entire job is figuring out whether a particular transaction might violate OFAC regulations. They use specialized software. They subscribe to data feeds. They hire former OFAC officials. The cost of compliance is enormous, but the cost of getting it wrong is bigger.
What does getting it wrong actually mean in dollar terms?
OFAC can impose civil penalties. The standard maximum under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, IEEPA, is the greater of about $330,000 per violation, or twice the transaction value. But those are the statutory caps. In practice, the penalties can be enormous. In 2019, Standard Chartered Bank paid over $1 billion in combined penalties to OFAC and other agencies for sanctions violations related to Iran and other countries. BNP Paribas paid almost $9 billion in 2014.
$9 billion for violating sanctions.
And that's not even a criminal penalty, that's civil. So when we talk about enforcement, the financial industry doesn't need much convincing to take sanctions seriously. The penalties are existential for even the largest institutions.
Let's go back to the mechanics of the specific case Daniel mentioned, satellite imagery firms. How do you actually enforce a sanction against a company whose primary asset is, essentially, satellites in space and data on servers?
Because it highlights how sanctions enforcement has evolved beyond just freezing bank accounts. For a satellite imagery company, the real pressure points are different. First, the satellites themselves. Many commercial satellites include U.S. origin components. Under U.S. export controls, those components can't be serviced or replaced if the end user is a sanctioned entity. So the satellite operator suddenly can't get spare parts, can't get software updates, can't get technical support from the manufacturers.
Even if the satellite was launched years ago.
The sanctions apply to ongoing services and support, not just new sales. And this is where the extraterritorial reach gets really interesting. If a European aerospace company manufactures a component that contains more than a de minimis amount of U.S. origin content, I think it's 10% under the current rules. That component is subject to U.S. re-export controls. So, the European company also can't service the sanctioned firm's satellites without violating U.S. law.
The satellite becomes a brick over time, essentially.
Or at least it degrades without maintenance. But there's a second pressure point, the ground stations. Satellite imagery requires ground infrastructure to downlink data, process it, and distribute it. Those ground stations are often located in third countries, and they're operated by companies that may have significant U.S. business interests. Once the imagery provider is sanctioned, those ground station operators face a choice: continue providing services and risk secondary sanctions, or terminate the relationship.
Most of them will terminate.
And there's a third angle, the imagery itself. The U.S. government can pressure commercial data platforms, the marketplaces where satellite imagery is bought and sold, to delist imagery from sanctioned providers. Companies like Maxar or Planet or Airbus, if they operate platforms that aggregate imagery from multiple sources, they'll remove sanctioned providers. So even if the Russian or Chinese firm can still technically operate their satellites, they lose access to the commercial marketplace where customers actually buy their data.
Is this all coordinated through OFAC alone, or are there other agencies involved?
The State Department has a sanctions coordinator. Ambassador James O'Brien has been in that role, who works the diplomatic side, getting allies to impose parallel sanctions. The Commerce Department's Bureau of Industry and Security handles export controls, which often complement Treasury sanctions. The Justice Department handles criminal prosecutions for willful violations. And the intelligence community provides the underlying evidence. It's a whole-of-government approach coordinated through the National Security Council.
When the U.S. sanctioned those Russian and Chinese satellite imagery firms, it wasn't just one agency acting alone. It was Treasury designating them, Commerce restricting their access to U.S. technology, State pushing allies to follow suit, and probably DOJ opening investigations into any U.S. persons who facilitated the sales.
The sanctions announcement itself is carefully calibrated. OFAC usually publishes a press release with very specific details about what the company did. Provided high-resolution satellite imagery to Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps entities for use in targeting U.S. personnel, and that public narrative serves multiple purposes. It signals to industry what kind of behavior will get you sanctioned. It provides a roadmap for allied governments who want to impose their own sanctions. And it makes it politically difficult for anyone to defend the company publicly.
Because now anyone who continues doing business with them knows exactly what they're enabling.
The public designation is itself an enforcement tool. It creates reputational risk that compounds the legal and financial risk.
I want to circle back to something Daniel asked about isolation specifically. When you designate a company, you're also designating its executives, right?
OFAC can designate individuals under the same executive order. And individual designations are even more disruptive because they follow the person, not just the company. If the CEO of a sanctioned Russian satellite firm is designated, any personal assets they hold in jurisdictions that respect U.S. sanctions are frozen. They can't travel to countries that have extradition or mutual legal assistance treaties with the U.S. without risk. Their children can't attend U.S. universities. Their personal bank accounts get closed.
That creates pressure from within the company. The executives don't want to be personally sanctioned.
Which is exactly the point. The sanctions regime is designed to create multiple layers of pressure: financial, operational, reputational, personal. You're trying to make the cost of the sanctioned behavior so high that the company either changes its behavior or becomes a pariah that nobody else will touch.
Let's be honest. Do Russian and Chinese companies actually change their behavior in response to U.S. sanctions, or do they just find workarounds?
It depends on the company and the sector. For companies that are deeply integrated into the global economy, that have international supply chains, international customers, international financing, sanctions are devastating. Even if the Russian government provides some support, it can't replace access to dollar-denominated markets. But for companies that are already largely isolated from the West, that operate primarily within Russia or China and their allied markets, sanctions are more of an annoyance than an existential threat.
A satellite imagery firm selling to Iran's military, that's probably already in the second category.
But here's the thing. Even if the sanctioned company itself doesn't change its behavior, the sanctions still serve several purposes. They make it harder for that company to upgrade its capabilities by cutting off access to Western technology. They deter other companies from entering the same market. Any satellite imagery firm watching this unfold is going to think twice about selling to Iran. And they provide a legal and political framework for taking further action if the behavior continues.
Deterrence, degradation, and a platform for escalation.
That's exactly the framework. And there's a fourth element, signaling. Sanctions signal to allies and adversaries what the U.S. considers unacceptable. They set norms. Even if the immediate operational impact on a specific Russian firm is limited, the broader message to the satellite imagery industry is, this market is off limits.
You mentioned earlier that companies can challenge SDN designations in court. How often does that actually work?
Not often, but it does happen. The standard of review is deferential to the government. Courts will uphold a designation if OFAC's determination is supported by substantial evidence and not arbitrary or capricious. But OFAC does make mistakes. There have been cases where companies or individuals were designated based on faulty intelligence or mistaken identity, and they eventually got delisted after litigation or administrative appeal.
How do you even file an administrative appeal? Is there a process for that?
OFAC has a delisting procedure. A designated person or company can submit a petition for removal along with supporting evidence. OFAC reviews it. Sometimes it takes months, sometimes years. And they can either remove the designation, modify it, or deny the petition. There's also the option of filing a lawsuit in federal district court under the Administrative Procedure Act. But the burden of proof is on the petitioner, and OFAC can rely on classified evidence that the petitioner never gets to see.
That seems like a pretty steep hill to climb.
And that's by design. The system is weighted toward enforcement, not due process. Congress gave the executive branch broad authority under IEEPA precisely because they wanted the government to be able to act quickly and decisively in national security matters. The trade-off is that some people get caught up who shouldn't be, and the remedies are limited.
Let's talk about the international dimension. When the U.S. designates a Chinese satellite imagery firm, does China respect that sanction?
China doesn't recognize unilateral U.S. sanctions, and they've actually been building out alternative financial infrastructure precisely to reduce their vulnerability to U.S. sanctions pressure. Their cross-border interbank payment system, SIP, is designed as an alternative to SWIFT for yuan-denominated transactions. But it's still relatively small compared to the dollar system, and most international trade is still dollar-denominated.
A Chinese firm that's already operating primarily in yuan and dealing mostly with Chinese and Russian customers might be relatively insulated.
But even Chinese firms often have some dollar exposure. They might have suppliers who invoice in dollars, or customers in developing countries who pay in dollars, or technology licenses from Western companies. The sanctions force them to restructure all of that, which is costly and disruptive. And the reputational effect matters even in China. State-owned banks may become more cautious about dealing with a sanctioned company because they don't want to jeopardize their own international operations.
There's something I've always wondered about enforcement. You mentioned banks run automated screening against the SDN list. How do they handle false positives? If a company's name is similar to a sanctioned entity, but not the same, do transactions just get blocked?
False positives are a massive operational challenge. Banks flag millions of transactions a day, and a significant percentage are false matches. They have compliance analysts who manually review the flagged transactions to determine whether it's a true match or a false positive. If it's a true match, the transaction is blocked and the bank files a blocked property report with OFAC. If it's a false positive, the transaction is released. The whole process is supposed to happen quickly, for wire transfers, often within hours.
If you're the company whose transaction got flagged because your name is similar to a Russian satellite firm, you're sitting there wondering why your payment isn't going through.
Banks often can't tell you why, because tipping off a sanctioned party about a potential investigation is itself a violation. So, you just get a vague message about compliance review, while the bank figures out whether you're actually the SDN-listed entity or just share a similar name. It's one of the hidden costs of the sanctions regime. It creates friction in legitimate commerce.
Which brings us back to Daniel's question about isolation. The system is designed to target specific companies, but the reality is messier. The 50% rule, the false positives, the de-risking. They all mean the impact radiates beyond the intended target.
That's the fundamental tension in sanctions policy. You want the sanctions to be broad enough to be effective, to prevent evasion, to deter third parties, to create real pressure. But you also want them to be narrow enough to avoid humanitarian harm, to avoid alienating allies, to avoid disrupting legitimate commerce. Every designation is a judgment call about where to strike that balance.
In the satellite imagery case, where do you think that balance landed?
I think the Treasury Department was relatively precise here. They designated specific firms that they could clearly tie to Iranian military targeting. They didn't sanction the entire Russian or Chinese space industry. They used the evidentiary package to draw a bright line. This specific behavior by these specific companies crosses the line. And they coupled it with industry guidance that tells everyone else how to stay on the right side of that line.
The enforcement mechanism, the freezing of assets, the secondary sanctions risk, the export controls, all of that is calibrated to isolate those specific firms from the global economy while minimizing spillover.
In practice, the spillover is never zero. But that's the trade-off the U.S. government has accepted. They'd rather err on the side of too much pressure than too little, especially when American lives are at stake.
Which, in this case, they were. Iranian-backed militias have been targeting U.S. personnel in the region for years, and satellite imagery makes that targeting more precise and more lethal.
That's the context Daniel's question lives in. This isn't abstract. The sanctions are a direct response to a threat.
All right, so let's synthesize this for Daniel. When the US government wants to isolate a specific company, they start with an intelligence build, months of evidence gathering to establish exactly what the company did and who owns it. Then they designate the company and its key executives onto the SDN list. That triggers an automatic freeze of any assets within U.S. jurisdiction and activates the 50% rule, which extends the sanction to any entity the designated company majority owns.
Simultaneously, FinCEN alerts financial institutions globally. Banks run automated screening and freeze any accounts or transactions linked to the designated entity. Export controls restrict access to U.S. origin technology and services. The State Department pressures allies to impose parallel sanctions, and the public designation creates reputational risks that isolates the company from commercial counterparties even in jurisdictions that don't formally recognize U.S. sanctions.
The enforcement isn't done by U.S. agents physically preventing transactions. It's done by the global financial system itself, which has too much to lose from defying U.S. sanctions. The dollar clearing system is the ultimate enforcement mechanism.
For companies that are already largely outside the dollar system, the sanctions still bite through technology restrictions, through the chilling effect on third-party business relationships, and through the personal impact on designated executives. The goal isn't always to change the company's behavior directly. Sometimes it's to degrade their capabilities, deter others from following their example, and establish a legal framework for further escalation.
One final thought, and this is more forward-looking. There's been a lot of discussion in the last few years about alternatives to the dollar system. BRICS countries talking about a common currency, China building out SIPs, Russia developing its own payment messaging system. If those efforts succeed over the next decade, does the sanctions enforcement mechanism we've described still work?
That's the multi-trillion dollar question. The dollar's dominance in international finance isn't guaranteed forever. If alternative systems reach critical mass, if you can conduct international trade entirely outside the reach of U.S. jurisdiction, then the enforcement model we've described starts to break down. Sanctions would still work for entities with U.S. exposure, but the net would be smaller.
Which suggests there's a clock running on this approach. The U.S. is using financial dominance as a national security tool, but that dominance creates incentives for adversaries to build alternatives.
They are building them. The question is whether those alternatives can scale before the U.S. sanctions regime achieves its strategic objectives. It's a race, and I'm not sure which side is winning.
Something to watch. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late 1600s, naturalists sailing through the Drake Passage first documented epiphytic ferns colonizing the rigging of ships, an observation that led the botanist John Ray to coin the term epiphyte from the Greek epi, meaning upon, and phyton, meaning plant. He originally applied it to any plant growing on another plant, regardless of whether it was parasitic, and the narrower modern definition, a plant that grows on another plant without drawing nutrients from it, didn't solidify until the 19th century.
John Ray was just out there naming things, and hoping the definitions would sort themselves out later.
Honestly, respect the confidence.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you want more episodes, find us at My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.